I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, the Democratic state lawmaker who is behind a bill that would ease sentencing enhancements for things like gun crimes and gang activity joins us. Plus,
they're banging on the door.
Left-wing anarchists swarm, barricade, and intimidate a group of conservatives on the campus of the University of Washington. And it's looking like Governor Bob Ferguson's first big test could be rent control. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. We have a ton to get to today. Just before we came on the air, I got done taping an interview with State Representative Roger Goodman. He is the Democrat who is the chair of the House Public Safety Committee, which has been hearing some of the what I consider very soft on crime, pro-criminal bills that have been introduced by Democrats. In fact, as we discussed on the show yesterday, he is behind what I have called the worst bill of the legislative session, House Bill 1178, which will help ease and even eliminate some sentencing enhancements for gang members, for criminals who use a gun, for people who cook meth around kids. He was kind enough to speak with me about my criticisms of that bill. So we're going to have that interview coming up in just a few minutes on the show. But I do need to start with what happened yesterday on the campus of the University of Washington. So it's one of those days where we're going to get to our favorite segment right off the top of the show. It is our segment on Freakin' Believable. Oop. All right. So, first of all, we already know. This goes so... It almost doesn't work out more perfect than this, that we're talking yesterday about the pardons of the J6ers. And how, look, like, I want to be very consistent, morally consistent on political violence. I have condemned and reported on political violence for my entire career in Seattle from the left. It's one of the reasons why I am so outraged by Washington's Domestic Violent Extremism Task Force, put together by Bob Ferguson, because they completely ignore the most prevalent kind of political violence in Washington state, and that's the left, anarchists, Antifa, BLM, the things we've seen play out in front of news cameras over and over. They focus on right-wing, white supremacist violence, and it was born out of and after January 6th. And so I disagree with some of the pardons in the way that the J6 issue was dealt with. Some of them, I think, are very legitimate, but at the core is a frustration that there's two tiers of justice for political violence. One tier of justice on the right, where you go to federal prison for maybe 20 years, and another tier of justice on the left, where you don't even get arrested, and you're allowed to continue the behavior over and over and over again, and nothing ever happens to you. What happened at the University of Washington last night is a prime example of this. So there was a woman named Olivia. I'm going to butcher her last name, so I'm not even going to try. She is with the Riley Gaines Center. And so she focuses on this issue of protecting girls' spaces, protecting girls' sports. And so obviously it was a very timely event that she was going to be hosting at the University of Washington, because they say they're a free speech campus. So you can have right-wing protect women event there, but it was held by Turning Point USA. So Turning Point USA hosting this event at UW had been pretty well publicized. Olivia is going to be there speaking to just a small group of students. Our friend Jonathan Cho, God bless Jonathan Cho. He was all over the place yesterday. What will we do without him? He sets this up for us. So, I mean, the second, you know, this event begins, it's being disrupted by Antifa and far-left demonstrators who initially... The disruption was outside, right? So here's Jonathan Cho setting this up for us.
This was supposed to be an event here at the UW, another Turning Point event that should have gone off without a hitch. But instead, some activists infiltrated the room, pulled the fire alarm, and now we're trying to figure out how to turn this fire alarm off.
It's the fact that they're censoring our speech now. They're not allowing the people who actually want to attend the event in the room.
Isn't that the irony here? They're trying to cancel your speech.
Yeah.
They're the side that keeps trying to censor common sense.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so they're calling them TERFs, you know, transgender exclusionary radical feminism. Same when Nicole and I got protested for being transphobes, for supporting parental rights. It's the who's who. So they infiltrate it and they can't even tolerate. Oh my God, we can't, our ears can't even bear speech we disagree with. So it's like, why'd you come in the room then? And so they pull the fire alarm to try to disrupt the event. They're ended up escorted out. And then also, so they're trying to figure out how to turn off the fire alarm. And then there's this higher pitch sort of beeping that's going on. Well, it turns out from the outside, these protesters busted in one of the windows and threw in this sort of sound-making device. Here's a clip.
Wow, they broke the window.
Yeah, officer finds it. Smashes it. They broke a window, which, of course, why would they not? That's the question I would ask. Why would they not? These are the exact same people who were terrorizing the campus of the University of Washington with the whole pro-Hamas sit-in. And they broke windows and they vandalized and they spray painted and nothing ever happened to them. In fact, the university made concessions for them. Oh, here's all the things we're going to do to investigate Islamophobia and all this. So why would they not? I mean, why would they not? They've done this behavior so many times. It's the same people. So then things got pretty scary, honestly. And I put myself in the position. I mean, I know what it's like to be surrounded by a mob. I know what it's like to be trying to keep your cool as a young woman. And have people terrorizing you. So Olivia's in the room and all of a sudden, you know, the people who'd come in and pull the fire alarm, they're escorted out. Police are inside and the doors to the room are closed. And that's when these left-wing terrorists start, we got all these flashlights banging on the door. This is what was going on from Olivia's perspective.
They're banging on the door. We were finally able to get into the room. We have a couple people in here with us and they just keep banging on the doors. Really annoying. Yelling.
Screaming. Anybody in there? Here's what I want to... You know, I'm a fan of law enforcement. What the hell are those cops doing? I have no doubt they've been told to stand down. Imagine you've got young adults in this room. They're for a free speech event. A young woman... And you've got these terrorists slamming on the door. Anybody in there? Open up, open up. And the cops are just standing there casually? I'm going to give those individual officers the benefit of the doubt and assume that their bosses have told them to stand down. We've reached out to the University of Washington today to ask why the hell they cannot control or refuse to control left-wing extremists who terrorize young people, including students, on their campus. So things just got worse. Now, outside, there's a huge group. And they surrounded, according to Jonathan Cho, the entire building. They're monitoring all the entrances and exits. They have this group barricaded, which should be unlawful imprisonment. Barricaded in the room. Barricaded in the building. Flashbacks to when my crew was barricaded in the fire station during CHOP. When they went to the back door and the front door. There was no way out for us. Absolutely horrifying outside. So Bennett Hasselton has been on our show before. Bennett Hasselton, he's a leftist, but he kind of shows up at these protests and he'll hold these big signs with something clever written on him. And he never engages in like violence. You know, he'll usually just sort of try to talk to people about his position on things. But for some reason, even Antifa even hates Bennett. Because he, you know, he won't engage in their sort of tactics. He's been assaulted by Antifa at an event previously. He'll actually acknowledge the existence of Antifa because he's outside with one of his signs and he's trying to tell Antifa like, hey, you know, disagreement isn't violence, so to speak. And they, looks like they punched him in the face or pushed him. Here's a video.
Okay, a man disagreeing with you is not a predator.
Yep. A man disagreeing with you is not a threat or a predator, he says, or something. And so they just assault him. And he posted that and said, Antifa assaulted me. He also told me in a private message that he went over to the University of Washington police. And he says, I was just assaulted. It's on camera. I have my GoPro on. And they refused to do anything about it. Because they said, this is according to him, that they couldn't go into the crowd and arrest people because it would be dangerous. Aren't you the police? Isn't that literally your job? And sometimes your job is dangerous? Again, this has to be coming from the president of the University of Washington. And one of the things, and this got so bad, by the way, this absolutely just makes me so sad. So eventually the kind of crowd disperses. And again, a lot of time goes by. And UW police, to get the people who were in the room for the actual event out after the crowd dispersed, just make them sit in there barricaded, held hostage, essentially. They come in and they're like, we'll escort you out three at a time. Here's a video.
First three that are ready to go, let's go.
Ladies first. This is unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
And UW students are being escorted out by law enforcement due to the far left activists intimidating.
Have to be escorted out to safety at your own school where you paid tuition in groups of three.
Red Square?
Red Square, that way.
Thank you.
Unbelievable.
Got it.
Unbelievable. The University of Washington should be absolutely ashamed of itself. We've reached out not only to UW police, but also to the University of Washington. We want to know why were police so passive in that. Do you think for one second if the Proud Boys came to the campus of the University of Washington on Monday and disrupted an MLK event, surrounded a building, the Proud Boys surrounded a building, were banging on doors with maybe students of color inside who were there for MLK, do you think for one second that the police would not have arrested them, that they wouldn't have swooped in their riot gear, that UW wouldn't have directed them to do everything in their power to protect those students, which they should? I don't care what your political beliefs are. I don't care what the group inside is talking about. It's political extremism, and this happens over and over and over again. Not only across our state and across our nation when it comes to left-wing violence, but on the campus of the University of Washington. It's disgusting. And what is our brand new governor doing? What is our brand new governor doing? Let's see. I just want to double check because I don't know. Maybe he has said something since then.
He has said something since then, since our last update.
Since our last update, you're saying he has said something about this?
No.
Yeah. So I went and looked. I'm so pissed off. So as this is happening yesterday, the last thing he'd been tweeted yesterday from his governor's account, you could have guessed it. Suing Donald Trump. Suing Donald Trump. Supporting. We started preparing for this scenario more than a year ago. The excellent team at the Attorney General's office is ready to fight this unlawful action. They will have the full support of my administration. So, praising the suing of Donald Trump. That's what he's focused on. He's the same person he has always been. Well, his alma mater, by the way. And he expects us to believe that he's now some moderate. And he's celebrating over Donald Trump. And he's in the last hour even. He posted something about Results Washington, getting that back online, which tracks their progress. He posted something about their housing transportation subcommittee in Washington State needing more housing. So he's been busy. He's been a busy bird on social media. But he absolutely has not been talking about the violent left-wing extremists on the campus of his alma mater because he's not a leader. And he's never talked about those things. The only time he's ever called out left-wing extremism is during his campaign for governor. During his campaign for governor, where he called out the Hamas sympathizers who were blocking the interstate. The only time he'd ever done that, to the best of my knowledge. When the city was burning in 2020, when CHOP was taken over, the only statement he put out at the time was about racial justice and criminal justice reform. He doesn't care about that stuff because it's not politically palatable. So you have a governor, you have an attorney general, you have a Democratic majority, you have a president at the University of Washington, you have a domestic violent extremism task force that if it's doing its job should be focused on these exact things, but nobody gives a flying fuck. Nobody cares. Nobody cares if students who might be conservative or might be open to conservative ideas are harassed and intimidated and barricaded and unlawfully imprisoned. Nobody cares. And so, yeah, like, I don't want to hear what any of you have to say about J6. That's why it rings hollow to me. It's disgusting. It's criminal. It's criminal carelessness. It's corruption of a different sense. and they need to be held personally liable for it. Every one of those students who is in that room should sue the University of Washington and personally sue the president of the University of Washington. I saw Charlie Kirk, who runs Turning Point USA, send something out earlier about this instance, which is getting national attention. You know, Riley Gaines had tweeted out about it because this young girl works at the Riley Gaines Center. And Charlie Kirk basically said, well, I mean, what I took from it is he was going to be in contact with the Trump administration and seeing what they could do at the University of Washington to try to hold them accountable when it comes to, you know, federal funds or whatever it is. But this just shows you, like, Bob Ferguson is who he's always been. I haven't seen, Nicole, you have not received any sort of response from UW.
I have not.
At this juncture. I don't hear you. Yeah, I mean, that's not necessarily a surprise to me. I haven't seen anything from the UW social media accounts about this. And look, maybe they put out some sort of press release that didn't get sent to us, but you're tweeting that Bob's up there tweeting about all these other things, Donald Trump, which, of course, he was obsessed with Donald Trump for 4 years. Of course, he's going to obsess over Donald Trump now, but can't be bothered to stand up for people that are under attack by left-wing extremists. Won't even say the word Antifa, God forbid. So what do we do about this? What do we collectively do about this? Are we really just going to accept that one type of political violence is okay and one type of political violence is not? You know, there's this bill and it's just is relevant today. I think we'll talk about it in more detail maybe tomorrow or next week because we hadn't planned to discuss it today, but it just fits in so perfectly for this. When I say, you know, is one kind of political violence okay? Yeah, it is. So there's this bipartisan bill in Olympia that I actually like, and it's in response to the Hamas supporters, you know, blocking access to SeaTac Airport, blocking I-5, and what it would do, again, bipartisan, it would make the obstruction of like a freeway, for instance, a Class C felony. So you'd be talking about a felony charge if you're the one sort of orchestrating these sorts of things. It's House Bill 1323. So bipartisan, here's what Sean Scott, newest member of the Washington State Legislature, the socialist that the city of Seattle in all its wisdom decided to send to Olympia to make laws for the rest of us. Here's what he had to say about this bipartisan bill to make it a Class C felony to block a freeway for 5 hours, to block access to an international airport for 5 hours. He said, HB 1323 is a bipartisan bill that would make protesting on Washington state highways a Class C felony because mass protest will be a crucial tool of resistance to both federal fascism and local austerity measures. We must make sure it doesn't pass. Because mass protest will be a crucial tool of resistance to both federal fascism and local austerity measures. We must make sure it doesn't pass. So you know how he's going to make sure it doesn't pass? Because Sean Scott won his job, despite the fact he came out in support of the pro-Hamas demonstrators who were blocking critical infrastructure. Despite the fact in 2020, he said things were getting done in the city when police cars were burning in the streets downtown. He hasn't hid it. Why would he hide it? He didn't have to hide it. He said those things and he still got sent to the state house by voters in Seattle. And so now he's saying we must make sure it doesn't pass. Something tells me that he's trying to incite people to do what they did at UW down, I don't know, at the Capitol, to harass. I mean, God forbid you're one of these Democrats, Maury Leavitt, Hackney, that signed on to this bipartisan bill. Better watch out, Sean Scott and his buddies and his socialists and his Antifa. They're going to be coming for you. To me, because I know how he operates and what he says, just sounds like a threat. That coming from anybody else, if they said, we must make sure it doesn't pass, I would say, oh, they're going to, you know, debate against it and all this stuff. No, it sounds like a threat. Sounds like he wants to incite all of his socialist friends to go down to Olympia and to harass these Democrats into voting against making this Class C felony. So when I ask that question, you know, one form of political violence is okay in our state and one form is not? Yes. The answer is a resounding yes. And the only way to hold these people accountable is by changing who you vote for. I mean, I really had hoped, I mean, I don't know what UW's enrollment has done since the whole Hamas issue and takeover, but I do know there were a lot of parents who certainly aren't far to the right who were absolutely upset, parents of Jewish students and non-Jewish students, who were upset by the UW's handling. I think the only thing that'll change this at UW is they go broke, people stop giving them money, and people stop sending their kids there. So I know, Nicole, if you want to chime in, is your mic back on?
Yeah.
It's okay, great. So we have request out to comment for the University of Washington.
To both the communications department, yep, or media and to the campus police.
UW police. And again, no doubt in my mind, UW police are at the whim of the president of UW. Like, if they don't want them to enforce the law and take a passive approach, they're going to do it. They'd never do it. I almost think, Nicole, is this incitement to violence? I don't want anybody to have any violence.
No.
I almost think you have to have some sort of conservative
pushback,
something on campus, and see how they handle it. I mean, but the thing is, you would never get conservatives to go there and bang and threaten kids and harass kids and bully kids and all that. You just wouldn't see it. It wouldn't happen. So it's like, what do you do to show? Mm-hmm. We know they are profound hypocrites. We know that, right? I don't know what to do about it. If you guys have ideas about what can be done about it, let us know. I don't know what to say. I'm not shocked. I'm sad. I'm angry. I'm angry for Olivia. I'm angry for all the students who were in there. I'm angry for the First Amendment, because that what was happening there is not, that's not the First Amendment. Antifa harassing, banging, breaking windows, punching people, that's not the First Amendment. What was happening inside is the First Amendment. For the crime of wanting to protect girls. No wonder they need protection. That was Trantifa outside, which is a real thing. It's transgender Antifa. So there are a bunch of Trantifa members who don't like that this young woman thinks that men shouldn't participate against girls. So get this, get the irony of this. So you've got transgender left-wing terrorists terrorizing girls. Is that not the proof that we need to show you that maybe they do need to be protected from them? Like, you're really not making your own case very well. I'm so pissed off about this, because it just proves every single thing we say. And you think this will come up at the next Domestic Violent Extremism Commission? Of course not. We will also reach out today to Governor Ferguson's office, to the office of the new Attorney General, Nick Brown, because we know the old Attorney General didn't say jack about this kind of stuff. Let's see if the new Attorney General, when he's not busy suing the Trump administration already on day two, can muster up some sort of condemnation for what's happening. Gosh, absolutely outrageous. All right, we have a lot coming up still. Nicole, we're going to get to, I think, our interview coming up next, which got kind of saucy and fiery with Representative Roger Goodman. I would have liked to avoid that, but...
In the most polite way.
In the most polite way possible. I'm nothing if not polite. First, this weekend, Natchez RV Resort is having the new phase of their grand opening, and these are the best possible lots that you can buy out there, because nothing's going to be developed behind them. They have 25 extra large premium RV lots, amazing unobstructed views. So they have not only in the privacy behind them, obviously nothing's going to be built behind them, but they are the extra large lots. They start in the low 70s. There's so much to do there. Their pool's now open, their hot tub, they've got pickleball, tennis courts, dog park, human child park. I always put the dog park first. And just a ton of recreation around there. 300 days of sunshine. So make your appointment to check out one of these lots before they're gone. NatchezRVResort.com. NatchezRVResort.com. Okay, I talked about this on the show yesterday. I said I think it's the worst bill I've seen this session because it speaks to the lack of common sense, the focus on helping criminals and not law-abiding citizens. It's a priority issue, right? It shows what the priority of the majority party in Olympia is. It's House Bill 1178. Again, I encourage you to read it for yourself. It's not very long. It modifies existing law and changes or eliminates certain sentencing enhancements. So under our sentencing guidelines now, there are certain crimes that you can add a sentencing enhancement because of the nature of the crime or how you carried it out. For instance, if you use a firearm in the commission of a crime right now, there's a 5-year sentencing enhancement that prosecutors can add to that. You don't get good time for that, which means you're serving that 5 years every day hard. And so that is supposed to be a punishment for using a gun in the commission of a crime. You also have some other elements of that. For instance, if you are a gang member who's an adult and you recruit a juvenile gang member to commit a felony, basically on your behalf because they're not going to get punished as much as you would, there's a sentencing enhancement for that, as there should be. And for several other things. But what 1178 does is it eliminates or it eases some of those sentencing enhancements. To be able to cook meth around kids. Now, there's a sentencing enhancement for that. If 1178 passes, we'll ease that sentencing enhancement. Sexually motivated crimes. Yep, they want to change that. They want you to be able to earn good time if you get an enhancement for a sexually motivated offense, according to House Bill 1178. If you recruit a juvenile to commit a crime, a felony crime, as a gang member, they want to eliminate the sentencing enhancement for that. If you use a gun, a firearm, in the commission of a crime, which we're supposed to believe is like the number one issue in Washington state, gun violence and thwarting it and gun control, and at the same time that they're pushing all these gun control bills, they are pushing through this bill to reduce the punishment for criminals who use guns to commit a crime. So I railed on this yesterday. I posted some of the hearing about the bill on social media. It went crazy because people are livid about it. They really feel like we have a pro-crime, pro-criminal majority in Olympia. So Nicole reached out yesterday to the lead sponsor of this bill, who also happens to be the chair of the House Public Safety Committee, Democrat Representative Roger Goodman. And Representative Goodman is nice enough to join us today on Undivided. Representative Goodman, welcome to Undivided.
Thanks, Brandy. It's good to be back with you.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming on because by now I'm sure you know how I feel about some of the bills that have been on your committee, some of the bills that you have introduced. So I always appreciate your willingness to come and chat with them. I am going to be very blunt with you today, sir. Is that all right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Even if you said it wasn't, I was going to be anyway.
Well, I mean, that's the way you are anyway. That's why people like you.
So. Oh, I guess. Or don't like me. Here's the deal. I've said this behind the scenes. I've said it on my show. So I'm going to say it to your face. I have come to this place where I feel like some of these bills are designed to intentionally make the public safety crisis worse. I know you're going to disagree with me on that. I just cannot come up with any other reason in my mind why you guys on the Public Safety Committee would be prioritizing some of these things. So let's talk about, first, you can respond to that if you want, my assertion that I have made several times publicly that some of these bills are designed to make the public safety crisis worse.
Well, we probably should talk about individual bills because some of them have to do with sentencing, some of them have to do with law enforcement, and so forth.
Let's talk about 1178 then, reducing sentencing enhancements or easing or eliminating sentencing enhancements for some of these crimes like gun crimes.
Yes. So the bill that I've introduced would give judges discretion when imposing enhancements or an additional time to a prison sentence to order them concurrently rather than consecutively. What that means is that right now judges are not able to unstack weapons enhancements, for instance. So if you wield a weapon in front of five people, assault in the first degree, but no one got hurt, you still get 25 extra years on your sentence because it's 5 years per victim. But the judge, in a case where no harm was done, would not have the discretion to unstack and impose one or maybe two enhancements. In a case where someone pistol whips five people with a weapon and injures them all, well, then, yeah, perhaps that's deserving of an enhancement, a five-year enhancement for each victim. So the idea is to give the judge's discretion to tailor the sentence to the individual and to the circumstances. And this recommendation came to me from the prosecutors. And this recommendation was also unanimously supported by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and the Criminal Sentencing Task Force, which deliberated for 3 years on many sentencing issues and included all stakeholders at the table. So, and it was a unanimous recommendation. So the idea is not to lessen penalties, it's to give judges discretion on a case-by-case basis to order the sentence that is most appropriate. I'll give you an example. Someone was driving a car, 19-year-old kid driving a car, the two people in the back, they were the criminals. They went into the house, robbed them, beat them up, tied them up, stole their weapons, and then came back to the car and said, okay, drive away. This kid had no idea. He was just, you know, not innocent kid. And he said, wait a minute, I didn't know all this was going to happen. But because of accomplice liability, he was charged with all of that. And he said, I'm going to go to trial. I was just driving the car. He got 81 years because of all of the enhancements stacked on top of each other. And the two criminals in the back, they pled. They pled to somewhere between 10 or 15 years. And so it's those types of inequities, those types of clearly excessive sentences that do not meet the interest of justice that we want to fix. So that bill really, again, it was a consensus recommendation and it gives judges discretion. That's basically the bottom line in this bill. It gives judges discretion to tailor the sentence to the circumstances and the individual.
There's a lot to unpack there. I don't understand why prosecutors would bring you this bill, because prosecutors can use their discretion. We've covered a case. I covered a homicide case in the city of Tacoma where prosecutors bargained away and dropped a firearm enhancement entirely. Prosecutors do not have to pursue enhancements. So why would prosecutors come to you seeking that when they can do it themselves?
They've seen many cases where, particularly when it goes to trial, that so-called trial penalty, where when someone is not smart enough and calls for a trial, the sentence is usually very much longer than what comes out of plea agreements.
But that's a tool of prosecutors. I've had a family member who's been subjected to that too, who went through the criminal justice system, and they had a choice between going to trial and taking like 20, you know, the potential of risking 20 years of their life, or taking a deal for something they said they didn't do. And I disagree with that tool, but that's a tool of prosecutors. So what prosecutors brought this to you and said, we need to do this?
This was the Washington Association of Prosecuting Attorneys. It was the organization that, and this was years ago. This was before the pandemic. And so this has been some argument that because we've seen an increase in violent crime, which, by the way, is settling down. We can get into that debate in another interview. And we've seen the use of firearms in more and more offenses, that should be the reason that we shouldn't make this change. That has nothing to do what the levels of crime, levels, whatever is going on out there, doesn't affect each individual case and the judge's discretion to decide the sentence in each individual case. If it's a bad case, somebody got killed, a bunch of people got killed, you know, give it up, you know, lock them up forever. But if, again, if there was no harm done, and we have so many stories from the incarcerated at the hearing about their underlying offense, for instance, a nonviolent drug possession case where a weapon was found unloaded in a backpack, and that added multiple years to the sentence of a nonviolent drug possession case. Nothing to do with harm to anyone, just a gun happened to be there. So that's just one example.
Representative, not to be rude, you're making a lot of excuses for criminals. Oh, somebody had a gun, they waved it in front of five people, and oh, we should take it easy on them. We don't want to stack those enhancements. Oh, this 19-year-old kid, he just happened to be in the car with a bunch of gangbangers who are going to go commit a crime. I think that's what gets at people, is you're the chair of the Public Safety Committee. We're in a public safety crisis that has been getting worse and worse. Our homicide rate has doubled over the past 12 years. The numbers of shots fired and gun-related incidents specifically involving gangs. Yet here you guys are debating the merits.
But case by case, the public wants fairness in our criminal justice system. Fairness on both sides. The balance that we have to strike is trying to keep our communities safe, but also protecting individual rights. And that's a very tough balance. A lot of people take that for granted. And so when someone has committed a criminal offense, assault in the first degree, they're going to get a long sentence. And if there were five people there and they were merely wielding a weapon and no one got harmed, why should that person get 25 extra years when another individual might have, as I said, pistol whipped or shot them? They should get an extra 25 years, but the other person shouldn't. We need to make these very careful distinctions, because otherwise the public will not have confidence in our criminal justice system.
The public doesn't have confidence.
Very important to mention is racial disparities. There is no greater source of long sentences and racial disparities in sentencing from these weapons enhancements. The federal government does not allow the stacking of weapons enhancements. Most states do not allow the stacking of weapons enhancements. These are clearly excessive sentences that do not serve the interest of justice.
The phrase merely wielding a weapon is really throwing me for a loop. We have, and your committee is hearing some of them, Democrats have
introduced... You're going to spend 15 years in prison for that.
Democrats...
Right? Do you want them to spend 40 years in prison for where nobody got hurt?
But that
doesn't
not,
make any sense. The public does not support
that's not
that.
Happening, Representative.
It is happening.
I don't know
if you
what,
were in my committee and see the testimony.
I watched the testimony and I understand. But for instance, let me tell you about a young woman named Wendy Traynor. Wendy was dating a guy
you
named
can
Josh.
Always
Ellis.
Come up with a story, right?
You just came up with stories
sides,
too, right?
Both sides.
I know, but hear it out, because I think that's the problem. In your committee, there are a lot of stories being told from criminals, people who are sympathetic with criminals. And look, like I said, I have had family on that side of the criminal justice system too. It is a complete imbalance when it comes to who's advocating for victims. I don't see a lot of advocacy you talk about this equity issue, which, for the love of God, if I have to hear about this in the realm of crime, do you believe that there is a disproportionate impact on Black and brown people when it comes to being the victims of gun violence in our communities?
Correct, on both sides.
Why aren't we talking about that?
Communities of color and marginalized communities experience much more crime because of their having been deprived of resources for generations, and that creates disorder.
I agree with you.
And of course, but pile on top of that, implicit bias and institutional inequities, structural inequities, have a bias at every step of the process, from street level all the way to the sentencing court. So we really are trying to mitigate that bias and those disparities. And again, treat each case individually rather than tie the hands of the sentencing court that has no choice but to impose excessively long sentences when it's not appropriate.
Yeah, there is. The Wendy Traynor case is an example for me. Josh Ellis followed her across the country and shot her in the back of the head and left her body rotting and stepped over it every day to check on his dog.
Okay, fine. You can go into the gory details. That's very sensational.
No, it's not sensational. I covered this case.
It's inflammatory. It's inflammatory. We want to talk about
it. Is not inflammatory to talk about an actual case. You just encouraged me to listen to the cases of criminals who came to testify before your committee about why woe is them. So please do not interrupt me while I'm talking about a real case that just happened that is very relevant to what you're discussing. Let me just share what happened. Wendy Traynor was shot in the back of the head by Josh Ellis without her family being consulted at all. Prosecutors in Pierce County offered him 10 years, dropped a firearm enhancement entirely. That's 7 years good time. 7 years good time for shooting someone in a DV instance in the back of the head. Prosecutors already have discretion, and they use discretion to give him the lightest sentence they possibly could. And you know what, Judge
I'm assuming, and I don't know the case, I don't know what happened behind closed doors during the plea agreement, which is another huge issue. But if they believe they did not have the facts to prove what they wanted to get, and I'm sure they wanted more time, then they have to come to an agreement. They have to negotiate. Otherwise, there's going to be an acquittal. So each individual case, also in the prosecutor's office, they have to figure out what they can prove, and they engage in a negotiation and come to an agreement.
He confessed to the crime. But my point is, Judge Andre Penoliver, he's one of the most progressive judges, I mean, that there is. And even he at sentencing said he wished he could reinstate the firearm enhancement, but he couldn't reinstate it because it wasn't brought to the table for him. And so he gave an exceptional end sentence. He added what he could. And so he used his judgment in that moment. It was prosecutors who failed to use their judgment. I think one of the fundamental things, and I don't want this to get tense, but the Wendy Traynor thing, that's a case that really sticks with me. And I know her family is absolutely livid by this bill that you're pushing. And
yeah, I mean, it may have been that the prosecutor didn't push hard enough. Again, this is an individual case, so it's hard to second guess and you know, sort of relitigate that.
Yeah, I think the overarching
thing. That sounds to me like, if I were just a citizen, that sounds to me like the penalty should have been much more severe.
Yeah, it should have been.
In that case.
I think on the gun crime thing, this is what I really struggle with. And I genuinely want to have a conversation about this. No fewer than 12 gun control bills that put law-abiding citizens through extra hoops to be able to access a firearm, that add costs and regulations for firearm shops. We hear Democrats in Olympia all the time talk about the importance of gun control, celebrate gun control measures. Yet at the very same time, you guys are pushing a bill to ease penalties for actual criminals who pick up a gun and use it in a crime, making sure that
you just stated that in general terms. Don't just say picked up a gun and committed a crime should be have the book thrown at them. We need to have very careful distinctions case by case. If they picked up a gun and harmed someone, yes. If they picked up a gun and maybe scared someone, that's assault in the first degree right there. That's five years, enhancement on top of that, 10 years in prison for using a gun where no one was harmed. I think 10 years in prison for using a gun when no one was harmed is enough. I think 25, 30, 40 years for using a gun and really harming people, that's appropriate.
I want your
and
office.
That's what we're trying to do here.
If you can give me one example, send it later, whatever it is, of someone who had a gun in the commission of a crime and got one of those excessive sentences you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like you're telling me 25, 35 years and you didn't harm anyone, that the underlying crime wasn't serious? Because I mean, you can commit a robbery. And if you committed a robbery with a firearm, you be on the other end of that. You be the store clerk who's in there and you tell me that's not a serious crime just because they didn't hurt someone. I'll tell you what, someone walks in my door with a gun, I'm killing them. I'm killing them.
Yes. So if it's a robbery, is absolutely using a weapon when a person is present. It would be theft otherwise if a person wasn't present. By the way, if it's theft and a gun is present, and again, no one is present, you can have an enhancement on top of that as well. So, but if, assuming they shot someone or killed someone, that's another charge. That's murder. That's attempted murder, right? So robbery one wouldn't even be in the consideration. It would be a much more serious charge.
Yeah, it's just baffling to me here to hear kind of the excuses, like falling over yourself to excuse people who shouldn't probably have the gun in the first place, but actually use the gun in the course of a criminal act. And then all the bills.
We're excusing people. I don't believe we're excusing people for committing crimes.
I'm telling you, it sounds like that to me for sure.
We're punishing them, giving them long sentences, but not excessive sentences that are not in the interest of justice. I really want to foster public support for our criminal justice system. We don't have support for them all across the spectrum. And this is one of those refinements, and maybe it's too refined, maybe it's too subtle, but I do believe that sentences should be tailored to the individual, tailored to the circumstances. And these people are going to go to prison for a long time, one way or the other, whether it's 10 years or 15 years or 40 or 45 years, but it should be based on the conduct and based on the harm done.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I just don't think
that's what the prosecutors brought to me.
I think we're seeing a lot of low-end sentences. This has been a complaint for a long time. The Wendy Traynor case is just one example of a lot of low-end sentences, low bail, no bail, things like that, that have people really concerned that there is this push in the name of equity to sort of take it easy on criminals. Really quick, because I know you've gone way longer than we...
Bail is another issue, by the way.
We
have the fourth longest prison sentences in the country because the legislature over the last 40 years has continued to crank them up and provide no discretion to judges. So we're trying to refine the law, again, to provide the proper balance.
Yeah, and I think I would also just point to that. Washington State also, as a percentage, has the highest percentage of people in prison for violent offenses. We don't put people in prison for nonviolent offenses in the state. A lot of other states do. So that's why you have a lot of the other states, when you balance those out, that have people in there for less time, because they put people in prison.
I think that's good. I think that we should be confining those who are violent.
We have one
of the lowest incarceration rates in the country, and that also reflects that those who are in prison are the ones who should be there.
Two more quick questions. I know we've gone way over. I appreciate your time. Sure. You guys got rid of enhancements for a couple things, rid of them entirely, or this bill would. It hasn't been passed yet, including for an adult gang member who recruits a juvenile gang member to commit a felony.
Yeah, that sounds pretty scary. Well, the prosecutors actually recommended getting rid of this as well.
Well, they should be fired. Those prosecutors should be fired.
No.
Justify it for me.
The way the enhancement is worded in the law, it's unusable. Perhaps we could amend it, but what prosecutors are doing instead is seeking an aggravated sentence based on the same thing. If you're going to recruit juveniles into gangs, yeah, we need to punish that more. And so the sentences imposed in those cases use an aggravating factor to, you know, increase the time for the same thing. So this particular enhancement hasn't been used. It's been used once in the last 25 years, and prosecutors have given up trying to use it because it's just not workable. So that sounds kind of technical, but we are able to punish those who do that in another way.
Yeah, my concern with that is prosecuting offices vary county to county. I would be willing to bet, and I don't know what prosecutor runs the group or is, you know, president or whatever, of what you mentioned. I guarantee it's King County or Pierce County or some sort of liberal jurisdiction. I'll look into it. I don't know. Because then they're coming to you with all these things that they want because they're soft on crime prosecutors.
Okay.
And then the rest
of
the state's like...
That's where the gang is happening. It's Yakima.
They're not able to use this enhancement.
And
that's true, that's different. If that's true, that's different. The one other one that I'm just truly baffled by, the sexual motivation. Reducing or easing enhancements for sexually motivated crimes. Why is that something you're concerned with doing?
So that was brought to my attention, and I do intend to amend that. We are not going to be reducing enhancement time for sexual motivation. That was in the bill. I didn't see that, and that is an exception. We're gonna amend that.
It was in the bill. It's your bill. You didn't see it?
There was a broad provision in the bill related to enhancements being eligible for partial confinement and earned early release. And the sexual motivation enhancement is one of the 19 enhancements there.
Okay.
I did not intend to do that. And that is something that we're going to fix.
Okay. And the cooking meth around a kid, that's not worthy of stacked enhancements? Because the example you used with guns is, you got a gun, there's five people, you get five enhancements. Hell, if you're cooking meth around five kids, I want you to get five enhancements.
I guess it would depend on the, I'm just trying to think that through. Again, those enhancements would still be applied.
It gets rid of the mandatory stacking. So the mandatory stacking element,
stacking really applies to the guns. That's the issue, is the stacking of these gun enhancements, where it just is excessive. And so the judges want to, and prosecutors too, in some cases, would like to see them unstacked and have, and again, federal law and most states don't allow stacking anyway. So I don't know how much of an anomaly or an outlier we really want to be on this.
Yeah. And so I'll just take another look at it, because from your own bill, the two things that would get rid of a mandatory stacking is firearm and deadly weapons enhancements and cooking meth around kids, which I'm sort of looking at that and like,
which
why
doesn't
are we
happen anymore? It's
but
all
also,
standard
why
doses
are we
coming
focused
up in Mexico,
on it?
Right?
Why are we focused on it? What are you focused on to make our communities safer? What are you focused on to help make our communities safer and hold criminals accountable? Are there any bills like that?
Well, it's really in the budget. We're going to be needing to invest in two things. One is crisis outreach. Our public spaces are not safe, or they're not perceived to be safe.
Yeah.
People suffering from behavioral health disorders, rooting through garbage and urinating and lying around, and running afoul of the law, but there's not a lot of criminal intent there. We need massive crisis outreach on the streets.
Yeah.
That will make people feel safer, which will align with crime rates coming down to below 2019 levels now. So even though crime rates have come down pre-pandemic, people don't feel safe. And so what we need to do is literally clean up the streets and help those people who are suffering from disorders. That's the top priority as far as I'm concerned. Because
let law-abiding citizens carry their guns in those places, because you guys are trying to take away our ability to carry a gun to protect ourselves in some of those places. So if you could not do that, that would be helpful.
Okay. I mean, I could give you a bureaucratic response. That's in another committee, although I do sit on that committee. So.
I mean, if you want to be my personal bodyguard when I go to a drug infested light rail station, so I can't carry my gun there anymore because of Democrats in Olympia, but I'm just supposed to like deal with it. These are the things that don't make sense to me. And the thing about you, I'm going to tell you about you. You're such a reasonable guy. I've talked to you many times. You're on the show. I think that's a very reasonable thing. I appreciate it. So I have a hard time sometimes in my mind squaring that and other things I've heard you support and say with some of these bills. It really throws me for a loop.
Yeah, I mean, as far as keeping our streets safe, we need more police. We need to restructure the way police agencies do their work. Dallas, Texas, by the way, is the best example of reducing response times and increasing clearance rates or solve rates without hiring any new police. And we need much more crisis response. As I said, we need co-responders and community responders to make our public spaces safe. And I think I'm very strongly committed to doing that. The other thing, by the way, is domestic violence and sexual assault. You don't see that in public. That's happening behind closed doors. If there's crime happening in our communities, there's the headline grabbing, major crime, but most of the crime is behind closed doors. And it's domestic violence, intimate partner violence, and sexual assault within families. And it's tragic, and it's a chronic social problem. And so that's what I'm really trying to crack down on.
All right. Well, I could support that. Representative Goodman, thank you for being a good sport. Thank you for coming on. You ever want to call and run a bill past me and see what I think about it? Call me up, okay?
Let me escort you to the light rail station. Let's see what happens.
Please do, okay? Because I know that some unarmed community responders are not going to protect me from what's waiting there for me. So, all right, Roger Goodman, we'll let you get back to business. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
What do I say about that? I appreciate him coming on. I mean, very few Democrats in Olympia are willing to come on this show. I don't appreciate him calling, me just sharing facts of a real life murder case inflammatory and sensational. It's inflammatory to commit murder. It's inflammatory for prosecutors to go behind a family's back and give a killer 10 years in prison. It's inflammatory for Democrats in Olympia to talk about how dangerous guns are and to push gun control bills while at the same time trying to ease punishments for people who actually use guns to commit crimes. That's what's inflammatory. And, you know, I get the sense throughout that whole interview, it's like, well, you don't want them going to prison for this long, or it's racially motivated, or whatever it is. Those aren't valid excuses. It also doesn't explain why this is the priority. Million things going on, a crime crisis that we're in, a homeless crisis that we're in, a drug crisis that we're in. Why not use every second you can in the Public Safety Committee to address those things? Lowering punishments for criminals will not address those things. It will make them worse. That is just common sense. what your priorities are. Tell people a lot about you, a lot about your ideology. And you can't escape from that now. You can't escape from that when you push bills like this. And let me also say, because this is my show and I can say whatever I want and no one can fire me. Nicole can scold me later, but on this one, I don't think that she's going to scold me. The equity issue when it comes to crime, the disproportionate impact on Black and brown communities when it comes to crime. What they never want to say, and what you'll be called racist for saying, is that's because a disproportionate number of Black and brown people are committing crimes. That is just a truth. That's just a fact. Now, I agree with the left on the cause of that. I've said it a million times. I agree that you have these communities that are having disproportionate impacts because of this country's legacy, because of Jim Crow laws, because of slavery before that, because we robbed generations of people from building wealth, from home ownership, from economic opportunity. There is absolutely a disparity. But that doesn't mean that you just say, oh, because of that, you get away with it. Oh, because of that, you don't have to go to prison for as long when you hurt somebody. No, you do everything you can to address those economic opportunities, to catch those communities up so they aren't committing a disproportionate amount of the crime. Because remember, a lot of violent crime is motivated by economic lack of opportunity. That's something that both sides should be able to agree on. And that's just a fact. You don't go around gangbanging. You don't go around selling drugs. You don't go around robbing grocery stores if you don't need the money. It's motivated by a lack of economic opportunity. So yeah, go ahead, do everything you can within reason to address those economic opportunities and those educational gaps. But that doesn't mean in the meantime, while you do that, that you say, oh, woe is you, you shot someone. I mean, in the Wendy Traynor case, the defense made Josh Ellis's race in black and white an argument for him getting a low sentence. Because of economic racial injustice, literally argued. I wrote an op-ed about it for the Tacoma News Tribune before sentencing. Literally argued that because of the color of his skin, he should get less time for shooting a white woman and killing her. That doesn't fly. The equity argument, the disproportionate impacts on Black and brown communities with policing. They're policing those communities more because more crime is happening there. Sorry, call me racist. I don't care. That's the truth. Now, there are ways we can fix it. There are societal reasons for that. And there are ills of this country going back decades, hundreds of years in of humanity that account for that. But that doesn't give you a free pass to victimize people. Doesn't give you a free pass to hurt people. And as I pointed out to the representative, it is actually Black and brown communities who have a disproportionate amount of victims of crime as well. When a gang member goes out and shoots someone, you're sitting here focused on the fact that that gang member, you know, more likely to be a young Black man. Who do you think he's shooting? A young Black man. I always heard this from gang detectives. Today's shooter is tomorrow's victim when it comes to the gang life. So who you're advocating for is the young Black man pulling the trigger and not the young Black man who's going to lose his life on the streets. You got to get that right in your head. You're never going to make a difference. Crime crisis is never going to get better. And you're never going to better the lives of those young people. You think by giving them soft sentences that you're teaching them a lesson? What lesson is that? We've seen it time and time again. You're teaching them that they can get away with the conduct that they're engaged in. We see it in courts in the city of Seattle where you've got young Black men who come in there on gang crimes, drive-by shootings, whatever it is, and they're shocked if they don't get let go on electronic home monitoring because that's what their friends did. Their friends got kicked out, no bail at all. They've come to expect it. And just one more thing on that. I know, again, we're going to go long on the show today. One more thing on that. One of these elements, these sentencing enhancements that they want to diminish, actually, this one, they'd eliminate entirely, is if you're an adult gang member and you recruit a juvenile gang member to commit a felony. They are thrusting young Black men into a life of crime because they know that the system plays nice when you commit a crime when you're under the age of 18 and you're going to get sent somewhere like Green Hill, then you're going to get just a little slap on the wrist and you're going to get to go home. So for those older gang members, they know that because they've been through that. So they said, hey, you go rob the store. You take this gun, you rob the store. Instead of me doing it, I'd go to prison for 10 years. You're going to go to Green Hill for one. And you don't think that there should be a sentencing enhancement on the books to punish them for doing that and for ruining any chance that that younger gang member had of a successful, productive life? And all of that to be said, all of that to just say, even if he can make a productive argument for these things, which he couldn't, it shouldn't be a priority. Lowering sentences at this juncture in the state, in the middle of a crime crisis, should not be on the list of the top 100 priorities that lawmakers in Olympia have today. So we'll have much more on those bills as they progress through the legislature. Just disrespect for... I'm just so mad about the Wendy Traynor thing, because to tell me I'm being inflammatory by sharing with you the real-life details of something that happened to her is just about all I could take to not quite lose my mind in that moment.
Well, appreciate him coming on. Sometimes I think a lot of these things happen not because people like Roger are purposely trying to ignore situations like Wendy's and, or, you know, things like Wendy's, but I think that they just surround themselves by people telling them the wrong things, and get them to focus on the wrong things. And so I'm glad that he listens, and hopefully he'll take that back and have that in mind at some point, right?
Yeah.
But
well, especially as a white man, you know, in this environment where identity politics is everything, and you're being told by, you know, women of color who might be on the committee, or by, you know, people who are testifying who are black, that this is about racism and all of this. And as a white progressive, you're just going to, you can't push back. You can't. What do you say to that? You know, well, I can't say anything to that. So you can't even make that debate that, hey, I get it. You know, we have some systemic issues in society to address, but this is not the way to address them. You know, letting people off the hook. So we have a lot of follow up to do after that interview. Some things he brought up. I want to know what prosecutors are trying to push these things. They shouldn't be prosecutors if that's their focus, and their focus isn't on victims of crime, and some other things. So Nicole's doing some follow-up on that today. So if there were loose ends to be tied up in that interview, we'll talk about it. All right, I'm going to talk about rent control coming up next. It might just be the first big test for this newly moderate Governor Bob Ferguson. First, I've encouraged you guys to take the First Mark Challenge. And hell, I'll even say, if you pay for this show, if you're one of our wonderful subscribers who pay $5 a month or $10 a month for this show, I'm helping you get that money back. So I'm basically offsetting the cost of an undivided membership by telling you to take the First Mark Challenge.
And then some.
And then some. Because people who take the First Mark Challenge often save hundreds, if not thousands of dollars a year.
So you should probably be a presidential, actually.
Yeah, at that point, if I save you, I saved undivided viewer Beth $4,000. Oh, I didn't. First Mark Insurance did. I'm taking a lot of credit here. But because we talk about it, she took the First Mark Challenge, saved $4,000 a year on her insurance. Beth, you should be a presidential patron at that point. Honestly, $250 a month, I saved even more than that. So it's not even break even. You're making money off this situation. All that to be said, take the First Mark Challenge today. FirstMarkInsurance.com. FirstMarkInsurance.com. It doesn't cost you anything. You never pay First Mark for their services. You just got to set aside a little time, talk to them about your current insurance, your insurance needs. They'll go out, they'll shop the market for you. They'll come back and tell you either, hey, I can't help you. We think that you have the best insurance at the best rate that you can possibly get, so I would really keep it. Or they'll say, hey, we can save you money. They saved Spencer, an undivided viewer, $1,600 a year. Chad saved $100 a month, so $1,200 a year. This ain't chump change, people. That's a lot of money. I don't know one person watching who would say, I couldn't use an extra $1,600 a year. I just like to keep giving that to the insurance companies. No. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you. And then after you take the First Mark Challenge and save money, then you up your undivided subscription. It's only fair. It's only fair. All right. I've said this about Bob Ferguson. I won't belabor the point, but he is going to have some tests ahead of him as the legislative session progresses. It's a long session. So remember, they have short sessions in Olympia and long sessions. This is a 105-day session, so it's longer. So throughout the session, of course, you're going to have some of, like, maybe the bill we just talked about, 1178, where they're trying to take it easy on criminals. You know, he's acting like a moderate. The test is going to be when these very, very not moderate bills make it to his desk. And we know one of what seems to be a top priority for Democrats is rent control. They gave it a hearing the first day of the session. It is already progressing through the legislature. They have the majorities to be able to push rent control, to cap rent increases at a time when we have a housing crisis in this state. At a time when landlords are already selling their units, they're being purchased by single families to be single family homes out of the rental pool entirely because of things like that. And so Bob is saying on one hand, hey, we're in a housing crisis. He's trying to lift red tape to be able to build more houses. And then on the other side, Democrats are working behind the scenes, his own party, to send rent control to his desk. That's going to be, I think, the biggest test of Bob Ferguson's newfound moderacy, is whether he's going to be willing to sign rent control in Washington state into law. And so the other aspect of this that I wanted to talk about today, we're joined by Morgan Irwin. So Morgan, he's going to probably, the name and he is going to look familiar to you. He's a former state lawmaker, but Morgan now works for the Association of Washington Businesses. And businesses have a huge stake in this because you need workforce housing. If we find ourselves in an even worse housing crisis, it directly impacts the economy. If you have any businesses that want to come here, that want to grow here, and there's not enough housing for their workforce, like, then it's just not an option for them. So there's so many things wrapped up in this, including the success of businesses. So Morgan Irwin, again, with the Association of Washington Businesses, was nice enough to come on with us and talk about this fight over rent control. Morgan Irwin, welcome to Undivided.
Thanks for having me on, Brady.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about rent control. I mean, we've discussed a lot on the show about how it's just a bad idea, just a horrible idea. But let's just work on the assumption that maybe it's going to pass. We know Democrats, if they want something to pass, it'll pass and it'll get signed by the governor. What impact, I guess, would that have on Washington state, maybe comparatively to surrounding states?
Sure. So just backing up just slightly before that, in Olympia, like, we almost never agree that we even have a problem. And when it comes to housing, not only does pretty much everybody agree that we have a problem, they even agree on what the cause of the problem is. And that, like, never happens politically, right? Where both sides are like, oh, we have a problem and we agree on what it is. And in Washington state, we have a housing crisis, and that's driven by supply. We don't have enough supply. Bob Ferguson's come in. He said he wants to build 200,000 housing units in his first term. Estimates show that we need 1.1 million new housing units in Washington state in the next two decades. And this is kind of universally agreed upon. So will rent control help this fundamental driver of this housing crisis in Washington state? And what we would say is no. Does this help people who have a current rental or that would rent in the next couple of years? Potentially, in the short term, that you can see some positive impacts for a very small group of people. But will it help anybody else? And again, the answer is no. I represent Association of Washington Business. We've got about 7,000 business members statewide, everybody from the really big guys, Walmart, Amazon, Microsoft, down to mom and pop tire shop. 65% of our members are 10 employees or less. And so representing kind of the entire state and talking to our membership on a really regular basis, we've got some large developers who've said, like, hey, we build in 5, 6, 7 states. If Washington state puts this in, we won't build in Washington state. Right now on the West Coast of America, California has rent control in place. Mm-hmm. Oregon has rent control in place. If Washington was to adopt this version of rent control, it would be the most restrictive version of rent control on the entire West Coast, making us not only go from being the most attractive place to potentially build these large projects to being the least attractive place, the least profitable place to build any sort of multifamily housing. And I can go through the stats and the numbers between Washington, Oregon, and California.
Yeah, and as far as the Association of Washington Business, I imagine you have a dog in the fight because you need workforce housing.
Absolutely. That's a huge problem that we work on all the time. And a lot of people think of that in terms of, like, our large urban centers, like, hey, we don't have enough workforce housing and people have to commute a long ways. It gets even worse if you go to a place like Goldendale or go to any of our smaller, more rural communities where we're bringing in industry. Simplot's going to build a new plant, or one of the other major manufacturers is going to build a new plant. It's going to employ a bunch of people. It'll really change that economy for the better in that area. But there's no housing within, you know, 50 miles, and trying to get those projects built, you know, in a state that's saying, hey, we don't want you to be profitable as an operator of these multifamily properties. It's just really hard because the economics aren't there if we take them away.
It's interesting because, I mean, the issues are related, obviously, and there's correlation between the two of them. But I think some Democrats see them as completely independent, like, oh, rents are high, and like the housing issue and the availability of housing and the supply is like a different issue. And they blame you for rents being high. I mean, you talked about some of your members, Amazon. They blame Amazon for rents being high. And so what they want to do is artificially cap it because they almost think it's sort of this, well, the rich people are doing it, you know, intentionally and driving up rents or whatever it is. But what's your retort when they say the business community is what's driving up rents?
You know, Bob Ferguson put together transition teams, various transition teams for various different topic areas. I served on one that was specific to housing that our lieutenant governor, Denny Heck, ran. And one of the presentations he brought in was the Low Income Housing Alliance. And this is generally a more kind of center left or left organization that's really focused on low income housing and tenants' rights and trying to help them. But then they also operate a large number of buildings and units statewide. And these are generally government subsidized rents and oftentimes government subsidized buildings that were built with grant funds because they're focused on that low income piece. And what Lehigh presented to the group is that a large number of their projects that are have all these subsidies for the renter, subsidies for the builder, subsidies for the operator, they're at risk of shutting these buildings down because they're losing millions and millions and millions of dollars a year. They can't force people to pay rent. They can't evict people when they don't pay rent. They can't evict tenants that pose a danger to their other tenants or to themselves. And so it's really a layered problem where we have the building side of things, and that's very important. And then you have the tenant side of things. And then the other side is operations. And so that's the Real Estate Landlord Tenant Act. And in Washington State, we adopted some really draconian codes during COVID. Some of them have eased, but many of them have stayed in place. And trying to make a building profitable, where you have to assume that 10 or 20% of people aren't going to pay rent and you can't evict them, means that you're going to raise the rents in those other units. And that's not something that any operator wants to do. They'd rather have a building of people that are at market rate and everybody pays their rent. And then they can bring those profit margins down to something that's going to have a solid return for their investors, but they don't have to gouge, you know, anywhere else. So it's really a layered problem. It's never just one thing when it comes to housing, but that for that stool, those are kind of the three pillars of like, we need to protect tenants. You know, 52% of Washingtonians are renters, and many of our employers and employees are renters, and we're sensitive to that. And we don't want them to be taken advantage of because then they don't want to live here. But we have to have a place for them to live. And if our operators aren't willing to build new buildings to house those folks, then there's no place for them to be.
Yeah, it is a layered problem. It's like a perfect storm. And it's hard for me to fathom why the majority in Olympia doesn't kind of see the storm that they've created and how it's actually making all the problems they say they care about worse. Really quickly, because you mentioned, so you were on the team that the now governor had Denny Heck run in his transition team to look at the issue of housing. And of course, he talked a lot about that. He came out with his executive order to try to cut down on sort of red tape and building time and all of that, which in theory would drive down the price of buying a new home. But rent control and the new governor's goals to expand housing are completely in conflict with one another. I don't know whether he'd sign rent control if it came to his desk. But did you get any sort of sense on that transition committee whether the governor would sign a rent control policy?
I did not get a direct sense of that. His housing advisor for his team is coming from the Tacoma area, so he just brought him in and that was announced. And he's lived through Prop 1 in Tacoma and the repercussions for that city and their rental market. So he's got a really very much a boots on the ground, like, hey, been there, done that, seen what this does. And it's been a little bit of a disaster in Tacoma. So I think he's got a pretty good advisor there. Now, whether or not he chooses to rely on the science and the experience that we have that says, hey, this really doesn't work, or, you know, is kind of engulfed in the larger political moment, you know, where there's a lot of energy around this, you know, I can't say, but it's going to be one of his first really big tests of, hey, am I a data-driven, you know, science-driven governor who's trying to do the best, or, you know, is there just tremendous amount of pressure from one side or the other that's going to force decisions. And we've yet to see who Bob's going to be or who Governor Ferguson's going to be on that. And the political nerd in me is somewhat excited to see that and how that ratchets out. You know, obviously his speech at the beginning of session was, I think, somewhat optimistic for a lot of folks on the right side throughout Washington State, folks who listen to that, folks who haven't. It's worth a look. I think Republicans stood more than Democrats did during that speech. But, you know, we're not going to really know where the rubber meets the road until we get to see whether or not he's signing these bills, whether or not he's going to veto them. He's been much more engaged than the previous administration. Many of his staff, you know, are actively seeking input, going out, talking to experts, and really trying to have real answers as opposed to just being somewhat apathetic, which is kind of what we ran into with the last guy.
Yeah, I share your opinion that I would like to see if he'd sign rent control, because it seems now so antithetical to what the person he's been the last couple weeks. But I don't want to risk it. Like, I don't want it to get that far. I'd rather they just sort of set it to the side before it even gets there.
I think your political moment of the year was when Inslee said that he didn't know the job was happening in Seattle. Yeah, you know, the news to me quote, right? That I don't think we're going to get that from this governor. This governor is much more engaged, and his staff is much more engaged, which is a positive thing, whichever direction he goes. But in terms of the real pressure test of, hey, are you willing to stand up to what is largely a liberal movement, not exclusively, and say, hey, the science doesn't support your desires, and we think it's better for the state to go in this other way? We don't know yet, and that's a hell of a test.
I agree, and I don't know if he's going to pass it, but I hope he does if it comes down to it. Morgan Irwin, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Did I say I hope he does if he comes down? I don't mean that. I hope he doesn't if it comes down to it. Although, man, you know, having Bob Ferguson be saddled with rent control would be kind of nice. It's like this constant pull I have between, like, what's best for the state and, you know, not preferring Bob Ferguson as a governor. So we'll see what happens with rent control, and it's moving quickly, so we're going to be following that. That segment is brought to you by our partners with the Rental Housing Association of Washington. It's why we've been focusing on rent control so much. It's an issue we care a lot about. It's an issue that would devastate the housing landscape in Washington and would ultimately get rid of options for renters. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. If you are a small to mid-sized landlord, become a member of RHA today, rhawa.org, rhawa.org. All right, and if you're thinking about selling your home because maybe you're a landlord and you've had absolutely enough of this nonsense, reach out to our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. Sellwithwes.com. Wes and his team have the best marketing strategy. I mean, when you look at other listings compared to the listings that they put forth for their clients, there's really just no comparison. Wes has been doing this for a really long time. He and his team can, well, first, I would say go to the website if you're thinking about selling your home. Sellwithwes.com, plug in your address and it'll give you, you can use your home value calculator. You can find out how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. And then the next step is getting a free market analysis from Wes, who can just tell you, hey, here's how other homes are doing. Here's how the market's positioned. Here's what you can expect. Because I think setting your expectations and just being open and transparent is a really important part of that process. And then he can talk about, hey, here's what I think you need to do with your home to make sure it gets the best offer possible. Maybe you're perfect and he says nothing. Or maybe he says, hey, it needs some cosmetic upgrades. Do you need help with that? They can help manage those projects, take the stress off of your plate, or else he can even help you pay for it up front, which I think is pretty cool and a pretty unique service. So sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, some national news. This story out of Oklahoma is bizarre. We don't talk about Oklahoma enough. Might be the first ever Oklahoma story on our show. I think Nicole and I are going to disagree on some of this. It's one of these examples to me of conservatives who actually go all the way in the opposite direction and engage in government overreach. Like Ron DeSantis does that sometimes, where I think he inserts like his conservatism onto the populace. This is totally that. So this from KFOR, Oklahoma. Marriage and child incentive bills look to curb divorce rate. First of all, it's not the government's job to curb the divorce rate. I mean, it's a nice goal. Involvement of government when it comes to trying to keep your marriage together via bribery with taxpayer funds doesn't make a lot of sense. But here's what they say. One proposal requires couples to attend marriage counseling before they can file for divorce. Like, no, the government can't require you to attend marriage counseling.
Well, I mean, you don't have to. But there,
it says it requires couples to attend marriage counseling before they can file for divorce.
Yes, so
that one does.
Well, it's for, I think that there's a stipulation to it. So you can get out of it somehow, but it's like, it's if you do, then you get a tax break. It's like a whole thing. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, that's stupid. Don't like that. Because I mean, I'm staying in my marriage forever. Love you, babe.
I mean, but what's counseling though? Like going to say, hey, this isn't working. The counselor goes, okay, see you later. I mean, it doesn't say you have to be in counseling for a year. It doesn't say, I mean, it goes like, see if you can work it out. Maybe you're just looking at things from a wrong angle. Now it does have outs for, you know, abuse and
yeah, it says
whatever.
The only way a divorce would be granted is if a spouse can prove abandonment of at least a year or abuse or adultery. So then you wouldn't have to like go right in and try to work it out in counseling.
I don't know. I don't think that's terrible.
It's not the government's place. It's not the government's place. And then it says the other gives a tax credit to married couples with kids as long as it's their biological child.
Yep.
So then you can't like adopt a bunch of kids. I guess they'd assume people would kind of abuse the system.
Right.
But like, what if you married someone and you're in a happy relationship and it's a stepchild? Yep, you still have a happy family unit. See, that's not fair. The bill also includes an incentive, $500 for each child under 18 living in the home of a mother and father while they're still married.
No, if they said I do before marriage.
No, that's the second one.
Yeah,
I'm reading. Come on, Nicole.
Sorry, I'm jumping ahead.
The bill also includes an incentive, $500 for each child under 18 living in the home of a mother and father while they're still married. And then $1,000 for each child under 18 living in the home of a mother and father who said I do before having children. So they're incentivizing like, you know, wait until marriage to do it and produce a child. It's not the government's role in any of that stuff. And it's also giving taxpayer funds to prop up what your idea of, and I think it's a good societal thing, you know, having the nuclear family. I don't want it to seem like I don't think nuclear families with a mother and a father intact and kids is a good thing. But having grown up in a home where there was a mother and father there for much longer than they should have been together, I wonder, would they have stayed together longer than they should have in an unhealthy environment because, you know, we didn't have a lot of money. They were getting money from the government. That wouldn't have been
would
a good thing
either.
They
had actually gotten married.
Well, they were common law married. Yeah, in the state of Minnesota. Right. But it's just like, so, no. I mean, let people do what people are going to do.
I think
if
the
you're unhappy.
Here.
Okay, go ahead.
Because apparently this is a thing in some states, I guess. But I think the intent here is to say that, like, Oklahoma has one of the worst divorce rates in the country.
Okay.
So they're trying to encourage people to take steps to enter into better marriages and make sure that you want to get out of it before you get out of it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It doesn't seem terrible. And what they're saying as a motivation for it is to, you know, kids do better if they have the parental unit.
100%.
And we all agree with that.
Yeah.
And then as far as the biological children thing, I don't know. I think it's an interesting concept to be like, hey, why don't you do it the right way before you like have this marriage counseling before you get married and then have the kid instead of like, let's just bust out these kids.
Yeah, no, some of that stuff I understand, obviously, the idea behind it. I do think it's a societal good to keep a nuclear family intact. That's just not always realistic.
Just not a government's place, I guess.
Yeah, but. And all you're doing is enriching marriage counselors who are like, they got to come to me, and you're just going to like sit in there and scream at each other, and you know.
That's true, but I do think it's a good conversation, having this bill, and sometimes I think that that's more what the bills are for than anything, is to create this conversation, and it gets us talking, it gets people talking about
how
these things impact society, I guess.
I can marriage, talk about kids. It without the bill. I don't need the dumb bill. We've talked about it before. Nuclear
you
families.
Should go into counseling before you get divorced. Yeah, no.
I wouldn't talk about that because that's a stupid idea.
Well,
you should try to work it out. The government, though, shouldn't put some sort of mandate that you have to do it. That's ridiculous. The conservatives, sometimes they just get too, again, it's all, politics is just a circle. All comes back and meets on the other
side. I wasn't here for this discussion, but I was listening for the pendulum swing.
Yeah.
Like, don't go too crazy because then it's going to swing back too crazy the other way.
100%.
Stay right here.
That's how we get it. Let's just like
a little bit back and forth.
All right. DEI is dying at the federal level. Chris Rufo put out a tweet saying he was talking with cabinet teams and a Trump cabinet. They're currently making lists of DEI employees who will shortly be getting pink slipped. It's beautiful, he said. Of course, Trump saying that was part of what they were going to do. And he's really wasting no time. So right now what's happened, this is from AP. So AP writes, Trump administration directs all federal diversity, equity, and inclusion staff to be put on leave. So that's what's happened. Right now they're on what sounds like paid leave. Mm-hmm. And look, they're federal employees. There's probably a process that they have to go through. It says the Office of Personnel Management in a Tuesday memo directed agencies to place DEI office staffers on paid leave by 5 p.m. today. So right now it's almost 5 p.m. So they got 40 minutes. Almost 5 p.m. in D.C.
5 p.m. I'm assuming it's Eastern.
That's
so,
what I mean.
Yeah. So there
so they
we
got
go.
40 minutes. And take down all public DEI-focused web pages by the same deadline. And they did that. Like, those web pages, whoo, it was like within minutes of Trump being sworn in. You know one they got rid of that I don't really understand?
Uh-oh.
They got rid of the Spanish language version of some government websites. That's just, that seems unnecessarily, like, mean. There's a lot of people in this country who speak Spanish. And I know there's this sentiment that, oh, you should come here and speak English. It's like, okay, we're a melting pot. That's what's great about our country. And wouldn't you want them to be able to read if it's like an ICE website or whatever it is? Wouldn't you want them to be able to understand like what they're supposed to do and rules and, you know, to do things the right way? It's like, no, we're just going to take down.
Yeah.
Not that you can't use translator apps and stuff to like, but that just seems needlessly like, screw you, Mexicans. Doesn't that...
But I mean, maybe that's to... that maybe that goes with this power thing that he's implying, right?
Yeah.
Like, I can change the name of the Panama Canal. I can change the name of the Gulf of Mexico.
Gulf
I can
of America.
Change the name of, you know, Alaska mountains and all the things. So, I don't know.
That seems a little too much. It's like, dude, some people speak Spanish or they're trying to learn English, but they can read much better in Spanish.
Right.
I know a little Spanish. Would I be able to, I appreciate when I go to Mexico and the menu's in English. I would order all sorts of stuff I didn't like if they didn't do that.
Yeah, would you go to a restaurant that didn't have it in English, though?
I have. Well, yeah, I'd ask them what it was. It would just be extra steps. I've been to a restaurant
that's the
that
point,
was...
though.
You're forced to learn. I've been to a restaurant where it was like Italian. It was in America. But the restaurant was so authentic. It was like Italian writing. I'm like, what is that?
Right.
But I don't know. I just think it's unnecessary.
Well, maybe it's a deterrent. See?
I don't know if there's one person who says, I'm not going to go to that country because the government websites aren't available in Spanish. That's a silly deterrent. I think he's offering a lot more legitimacy.
I think there's been a lot of deterrents. It's just one of the
mass
deterrents.
Well, you ask him.
Deterrent.
He's right behind you.
Right?
Ask him.
What are you doing here, dude?
What are you doing here, bro?
Yeah.
All right. One nice thing, I think. So it was funny. I don't know if you watched this when President Trump on day one was signing some executive orders in the Oval Office. Peter Ducey asked him like, hey, did Biden leave you a note? And Trump's like, I don't know. And opened up his drawer. There was a note in there from President Biden that he hadn't seen. And Peter Ducey's like, will you read it to us? He's like, let me read it to myself first. And then I'll let you know if I want to share what it says. So he did share what it said with Peter Ducey exclusively. Peter Ducey tweeted out, we can exclusively report for the first time anywhere the contents of President Biden's letter. And you just know that Trump messaged Peter Ducey and is like, hey, I wanted to let you know. So
hey,
this is what...
Oh, yeah.
This is what Joe Biden wrote to Hitler. Dear, that's all I could think about.
I know.
It's all because it's a nice note, right? Mm-hmm. But all I could think about is that one time he gave that speech, like with like shrouded in red, where he's like, Trump isn't and MAGA is an existential threat to our country. But then he wrote, Dear President Trump, as I take leave of this sacred office, I wish you and your family all the best in the next 4 years. The American people and people around the world look to this house for steadiness and the inevitable storms of history. And my prayer is that in the coming years, it will be a time of prosperity, peace, and grace for our nation. May God bless you and guide you as he has blessed and guided our beloved country since our founding. Like, is that the kind of note you write to Hitler? Well, I don't think so. And again, it's just because it's all smoke and mirrors, people. All smoke and mirrors.
I love when he found that letter. He said, I would have probably never found this because I never opened this drawer. Like, wow, you
so
don't open that
sense.
Drawer?
He let Peter Ducey be the first one to know what the letter said. And
the
it was
Diet
a very...
Coke button was back, too.
Yeah, I saw that. Trump's Diet Coke button. Love it. I think it was an ice cream button for Biden, allegedly. But okay, we'll get to our daily subscriber show poll. Your questions and comments coming up next. You guys were funny today. Funny on the chat today. Ha ha. First, Jack Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital are having another one of their live Know Your Risk webinars coming up on January 30th. So that's next Thursday. You can register completely for free. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. They have a lot to cover. They're going to answer your burning questions about Donald Trump, his economic policy, what it might mean for your retirement portfolio, etc. Talk about the current state of the market. Plus, they'll do a full reveal of how Bulwark is always looking for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, give your retirement as much upside as possible. You only get one retirement. You have your dreams set on what you want and you're planning toward it. The question is, are you going to have enough money? Like every person who retires, are you going to have enough money to live out your dreams? So you only get one retirement. You need to get a second opinion. So sign up for Zach's 2025 preview webinar, Thursday, January 30th. Register now at knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. Okay. I asked you guys in our daily show poll, it was a weird poll today because I wanted to see if any of you came up with something that I had not thought of when it comes to DEI, because I've often said, like, in the whole identitarianism thing, you know, there are very few jobs that the color of your skin should factor in, like head of the NAACP. Yeah, despite the fact that Rachel Dolezal was able to score that job, I don't think you should be able to be a white woman or a white person to be the head of the NAACP. That doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. So I asked you guys, do you believe there is a place for diversity hiring in government? If yes, please be specific. So many of you are saying no. A few of you said yes. So I look forward to hearing maybe what your thoughts are in that specificity. Nicole, do you believe there is any sort of place for diversity hiring in government? Have you pondered that?
I mean, I guess not based on those requirements. I don't think it should be a requirement that you have any color skin for a position like that, right? But I do think that you can have somebody, that's not their full job, but maybe part of their job is to make sure people are being hired for the right reasons.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think
because diversity is good, yes. But not forced diversity for reasons that are specific. Right. You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
You cannot hire this white person because their skin is white. Or you have to hire, yeah, I don't know. I just think it should always be the person that fits the job the best.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, so Bob put this on Patreon. He said, of course, there needs to be diversity in hiring, but it should be the natural result of hiring the most qualified people. To assume that there are not qualified minorities for virtually every job category is demeaning. And that's what I was saying is, like, it's demeaning for Ketanji Brown Jackson, I think, for Biden to have said, I'm going to hire a black woman or nominate a black woman to the U.S. Supreme Court. Because, like, by any standard, she was qualified. And so making it about her skin color and her race is demeaning. I 100% agree with Bob. Tony said, I do believe diversity hiring can be beneficial, but only very specifically. For example, suppose we decide we really want to help New Orleans out of the economic rut. We can't do that by sending suit-wearing white men to determine what those neighborhoods need. Nobody would talk to them and they wouldn't understand the issues. We need somebody closer to a neighborhood listener. And that probably means staffing at least part of the agency with folks raised in those types of neighborhoods who understand what causes the crime, the single parentage, and what destroys their small businesses, etc. And I do believe that there are government jobs that women are more suited for, that there are government jobs that men are more suited for, that there are government jobs that people of color are more suited for. The question is, like, do you go out and specifically hire people, like, because of those characteristics? And that's sort of what I was getting at with this poll. It's more of like a deep thinking one. Richard said, I believe in diversity of thought and experience. I don't think it should be measured by ethnicity, race, religion, gender, because one aspect of, like, DEI that's never included is economic diversity. Like, hey, do you come from a family that struggled economically? That can give you a whole different look at government and government programs and whatever it is. But we never talk about the need for economic diversity because economic diversity covers everyone. Of every race, of every gender, of every sexual orientation. I mean, you have white people who grew up poor, black people who grew up poor, gay and lesbian people who grew up poor, and nobody looks at that as an important part of diversity, which is sort of interesting. Amelia says, I voted no. However, the more important goal should be equality of opportunity. If we had equality of opportunity, we would need equality of outcomes. At this point, I'm not sure how to reach that. I think there has been in the past inequality, but I think we've come a long way. Yeah, we haven't. And obviously inequity and equity is different than equality. Okay, get to some subscriber comments here on various things. Monkey Finger says, my brother works at Olympic College in Bremerton. On inauguration day, he flipped out on me, called me a Nazi sympathizer, among many other vile things, and blocked from all contact, all because I don't share his political views. These people are unhinged and have learned nothing these past 10 years. They are entrenched and do not possess the ability for self-reflection. I know what Nicole wants to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Is everything okay over there? You're back there like, okay.
No, we had a little troll.
Oh, that's all right. Trolls are fine.
No, a spammer.
Oh, okay.
Spammer.
So this is funny because Nicole has lost some Facebook friends. You're okay to talk about that, right?
Yes.
Since going to the inauguration and posting pictures. How many down are you?
I think 8.
Oh, yeah. Man.
It's funny. I wish I knew. I wish Facebook told you who just unfriended you, but mm-hmm. I figured out two. But yeah, so I typically use my personal Facebook as just this is where I am, and it's not just friends and family, like close friends and family mostly. And so I don't get super political, which even in my post, I said, you know what, if somebody invited me to Joe Biden's inauguration, I would have gone too.
Yeah, that's cool.
I don't know who would have invited me, but like I would have gone. It's a historical event.
Yeah.
Anyway, and I posted pictures and whatever. I mean, within an hour, I was down 3. And then now I'm down 8 over the last, 48 hours, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, I just find it kind of funny. And they'll eventually pop up in my friend suggestions or whatever, and I'll figure it out. But yeah, one was a softball friend, and she's always thought differently than me. But she's always been very respectful, but I haven't seen her in a few years. And so I guess she finally had enough. And then one is actually the husband of a cousin, and I knew he was going to be gone too. So I those two are not super surprising. There's a couple that kept me that I'm surprised, and I'm like, oh, is that because you know my heart?
Or they haven't seen it yet.
Trump supporter is the is like this evil person that you claim that they are, because oh my gosh, I get so many, or there, I have a few people that I watch that I, you know, every supporter, F you, all of that. And yeah, it's just kind of
I wonder
funny.
If my mom was one of them. Are you friends with my mom on Facebook?
I am.
You should check right now and see if my mom was
she
one
would
of the ones.
Not.
I don't know. I don't think she's that. She really doesn't like Donald Trump. Wouldn't that be funny if we find out right now live that my mom defriended you?
Now, if she's watching, she's going to go on and unfriend me right now.
No, she's not. She doesn't watch this deep into the show.
No, she's my friend.
Okay, good. All right. Good job, mother. All right, let's go CHBediant. $5 for the swear jar. The incident at UW was scary and ridiculous. Just insane. Joel Brinken says, the University of Washington police work for the students and should protect them first and foremost. It's ridiculous that they stand by and do nothing. 100%. The students are supposed to be their responsibility, and these outside agitators don't go to UW. Greg Olakis, we need to call for the resignation of the UW president immediately. I agree. We should do a protest. Matthew Cook, a peaceful one. UW could easily... Yeah, she's on her way out. She doesn't care. Even though they vandalized her thing, that was the only time. Remember, Bob Ferguson spoke out about that when her stuff was vandalized. Ridiculous. UW could easily arrest and bar these criminals from campus. So if they were to set foot on campus, it would be grounds for immediate arrest. Yeah, trespass them. You can trespass, I think, if there's a criminal reason from a public place. Joanne Moore, that's a Democrat for you. They immediately get mad when you try to tell the truth about something. They didn't want to hear it. I assume that's about our... I don't think Roger Goodman got mad, but he accused me of being inflammatory while telling the details of a crime, which is just ridiculous. Or maybe you're talking about Antifa. I don't know what that meant. Adorable deplorable, I got to quit my job so I can just live stream this show more often. Yeah, just quit your job. Live stream the show. It'll be great.
Right.
Country Guy, $10 super chat for the swear jar. I wish we could withhold subsidizing UW in our taxes until they really endorse justice for both sides. Nicole, can you check on that? There's the one that's highlighted in green. Is that a super chat? Gray Death, if the prosecutors don't use it, then it is a moot point already. The judges shouldn't be making laws talking about these changes in sentencing guidelines. Jamie says, State Rep Goodman doesn't know his own bill. Yeah, sure. Why do you think we the people don't believe these elected officials? Brandy, you are so calm and collected. Oh my, this guy. Matt Gilbert, I love you, but I'm not going to read this because I don't know if it's a threat. I don't know if it's a... What is that?
It's a quote.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't know what it means, so I'm not going to say it, but I'll give you $5 next time I see you. That's it. Right?
I think that's it.
Because I'm like, what is that? I don't know what that means. but thank you. I'll give you $5. I'll buy you a coffee next time I see you. With that, Nicole, thank you for sharing. Yeah. I'm sorry. I hope you don't lose any more friends. But now that I know she can't see it, I'm going to unfriend her too.
No, oh, I'm just I would kidding. Notice.
She would notice that. I never use my personal Facebook page. With that, another episode of Undivided Overtime. We're doing like 2-hour shows now. Might as well just ratchet it up.
Why not?
Let's get to our closing sanity check and have a good laugh today, shall we? All right. You know, I'm nothing if not a major football fan, rah, rah. This Sunday, the NFC Championship game is going to be played between the Eagles and the Commanders, and the Philadelphia mayor, as she should, is trying to rile up and get excited Eagles fans.
Let me hear you all say, E-L-G-F-E-S, Eagles! Let's go, Birds!
E-L-G-F-E-S, Eagles!
Let's go, Birds!
Let's go, Birds! Do it with me, Nicole. Everybody, E-L-G-S-E-S. Go Eagles.
She doesn't even know she messed
up. I love all the people around her, the total bootlickers who are like trying to spell it wrong with her so she doesn't feel so bad. Wasn't even close. E-L-G-S-E-S. It's okay. It's fine. You know, we all get a little excited.
That's our bird.
That's
the country's bird, and you don't know how
it is our bird. It. Oh, man. Just a good laugh. That's our closing sanity check for today. That's today's episode of Undivided. Thank you to all our subscribers who support our work and help us do this job full time, where we get to talk about all the terrible things happening in Olympia and around the country. But, you know, sometimes we include fun things. We have fun things too. If you haven't signed up to support the show already, you can do that for just $5 a month, undividedpod.com. UndividedPod.com, and please don't unfriend Nicole on Facebook. It hurt. She's putting up a strong front, but her feelings are hurt.
I don't like it.
She's a good person, and she's counting her friend count very closely. So, you know, I can't have her sad. Anyway, all right, we'll see you guys back on the live show tomorrow at noon. And adorable deplorable, don't quit your job. You can always watch the show back if you don't watch it live.